Chapter 15. But Shiloh did not appear for some time, and Vinicius knew not at last what to think of his absence. In vain he repeated to himself that searching, if continued to a certain and successful issue, must be gradual. His blood and impulsive nature rebelled against the voice of judgment. To do nothing, to wait, to sit with folded arms, was so repulsive to him that he could not be reconciled to it in any way. To search the alleys of the city in the dark garb of a slave, through this alone, that it was useless, seemed to him merely a mask for his own inefficiency, and could give no satisfaction. His freedmen, persons of experience, whom he commanded to search independently, turned out 100 times less expert than Chio. Meanwhile there rose in him, besides his love for Lygla, the stubbornness of a player resolved to win. Vinicius had been always a person of this kind. From earliest youth he had accomplished what he desired with the passionateness of one who does not understand failure or the need of yielding something. For a time military discipline had put his self-will within bounds, but also it had engrafted into him the conviction that every command of his to subordinates must be fulfilled. His prolonged stay in the Orient, among people pliant and inured to slavish obedience, confirmed in him the faith that for his wish there were no limits. At present his vanity too was wounded painfully. There was, besides, in Lygia's opposition and resistance, and in her flight itself, which was to him incomprehensible, a kind of riddle. In trying to solve this riddle he racked his head terribly. He felt that Act had told the truth, and that Lygia was not indifferent. But if this were true, why had she preferred wandering and misery to his love, his tenderness, and a residence in his splendid mansion? To this question he found no answer, and arrived only at a kind of dim understanding that between him and Lygia, between their ideas, between the world which belonged to him and Petronius, and the world of Lygia and Pomponia, there existed some sort of difference, some kind of misunderstanding as deep as an abyss, which nothing could fill up or make even. It seemed to him, then, that he must lose Lygia, and at this thought he lost the remnant of balance which Petronius wished to preserve in him. There were moments in which he did not know whether he loved Lygia or hated her. He understood only that he must find her, and he would rather that the earth swallowed her than that he should not see and possess her. By the power of imagination he saw her as clearly at times, as if as he had been before his face. He recalled every word which he had spoken to her, every word which he had heard from her. He felt her near, felt her on his bosom, in his arms, and then desire embraced him like a flame. He loved her, and called to her. And when he thought that he was loved, that she might do with willingness all that he wished of her, sore and endless sorrow seized him, and a kind of deep tenderness flooded his heart, like a mighty wave. But there were moments too, in which he grew pale from rage, and delighted in thoughts of the humiliation and tortures which he would inflict on Lygia when he found her. He wanted not only to have her, but to have her as a trampled slave. At the same time he felt that, if the choice were left him, to be her slave or not to see her in life again, he would rather be her slave. There were days in which he thought of the marks which the lash would leave on her rosy body, and at the same time he wanted to kiss those marks. It came to his head also that he would be happy if he could kill her. In his torture, torment, uncertainty, and suffering, he lost health, and even beauty. He became a cruel and incomprehensible master. His slaves, and even his freedmen, approached him with trembling, and when punishments fell on them causelessly, punishments as merciless as undeserved, they began to hate him in secret, while he, feeling this, and feeling his own isolation, took revenge all the more on them. He restrained himself with Chilo alone, fearing lest he might cease his searches. The Greek, noting this, began to gain control of him, and grew more and more exacting. At first he assured Vinicius at each visit that the affair would proceed easily and quickly. Now he began to discover difficulties, and without ceasing, it is true, to guarantee the undoubted success of the searches, He did not hide the fact that they must continue it for a good while. At last he came, after long days of waiting, with a face so gloomy that the young man grew pale at sight of him, and springing up had barely strength to ask, "Is she not among the Christians?" "Yes, she is, Lord," answered Shiloh. "But I found Glaucus among them. Oh, of what art thou speaking, and who is Glaucus?" "He thou hast forgotten, Lord. It seems, that old man with whom I journeyed from Naples to Rome, and in whose defense I lost these two fingers, a loss which prevents me from writing. Robbers, who bore away his wife and child, stabbed him with a knife. I left him dying at an inn in Minturna, and bewailed him long. Alas! I have convinced myself that he is alive yet, and belongs in Rome to the Christian community." Vinicius, who could not understand what the question was, understood only that Glaucus was becoming a hindrance to the discovery of Lydia. Hence he suppressed his rising anger, and said, "If thou didst defend him, he should be thankful and help thee." "Ah! Worthy tribune, even gods are not always grateful, and what must the case be with men? True, he should be thankful. But, unhappily, he is an old man, of a mind weak, and darkened by age and disappointment. For which reason, not only is he not grateful, but, as I learned from his co-religionists, he accuses me of having conspired with the robbers, and says that I am the cause of his misfortunes. That is the recompense for my fingers. Scoundrel! I am certain that it was as he says," replied Vinicius. "Then thou knowest more than he does, Lord, for he only surmises that it was so, which, however, would not prevent him from summoning the Christians, and from revenging himself on me cruelly. He would have done that undoubtedly, and others, with equal certainty, would have helped him. But fortunately he does not know my name, and in the house of prayer where we met, he did not notice me. I, however, knew him at once, and at the first moment wished to throw myself on his neck. Wisdom, however, and the habit of thinking before every step which I intend to take, restrained me. Therefore, on issuing from the house of prayer, I inquired concerning him, and those who knew him declared that he was the man who had been betrayed by his comrade on the journey from Naples. Otherwise I should not have known that he gives out such a story. How does this concern me? Tell what thou sawest in the house of prayer." "It does not concern thee, Lord, but it concerns me just as much as my life. Since I wish that my wisdom should survive me, I would rather renounce the reward which thou hast offered than expose my life for empty lucre, without which I as a true philosopher shall be able to live and seek divine wisdom." But Vinicius approached him with an ominous countenance, and began in a suppressed voice, "Who told thee that death would meet thee sooner at the hands of Glaucus than at mine? Whence knowest thou, dog, that I will not have thee buried right away in my garden?" Chio, who was a coward, looked at Vinicius, and in the twinkle of an eye understood that one more unguarded word, and he was lost beyond redemption. "I will search for her, Lord, and I will find her," cried he, hurriedly. Silence followed, during which were heard the quick breathing of Vinicius, and the distant song of slaves at work in the garden. Only after a while did the Greek resume his speech, when he noticed that the young patrician was somewhat pacified. "Death passed me, but I looked on it with the calmness of Socrates. No, Lord, I have not said that I refuse to search for the maiden. I desired merely to tell thee that search for her is connected now with great peril to me. On a time thou didst doubt that there was a certain Eurysius in the world, and though thou wert convinced by thine own eyes that the son of my father told the truth to thee, thou hast suspicions now that I have invented Glaucus. Ah! Would that he were only a fiction, that I might go among the Christians with perfect safety, as I went some time since. I would give up for that the poor old slave woman whom I bought 3 days since, to care for my advanced age and maimed condition. But Glaucus is living, Lord, and if he had seen me once, thou wouldst not have seen me again, and in that case who would find the maiden? Here he was silent again, and began to dry his tears. But while Glaucus lives, continued he, how can I search for her? For I may meet him at any step, and if I meet him I shall perish, and with me will cease all my searching. What art thou aiming at? What help is there? What dost thou wish to undertake? Inquired Vinicius. Aristotle teaches us, Lord, that less things should be sacrificed for greater, and King Priam said frequently that old age was a grievous burden. Indeed, the burden of old age and misfortune weighs upon Glaucus this long time, and so heavily that death would be to him a benefit. For what is death, according to Seneca, but liberation? Play the fool with Petronius, not with me. Tell what thy desire is. If virtue is folly, may the gods permit me to be a fool all my life. I desire, Lord, to set aside Glaucus, for while he is living my life and searches are in continual peril. Hire men to beat him to death with clubs. I will pay them. They will rob thee, Lord, and afterward make profit of the secret. There are as many ruffians in Rome as grains of sand in the arena, but thou wilt not believe how dear they are when an honest man needs to employ their villainy. No, worthy tribune. But if watchmen catch the murderers in the act, they would tell, beyond doubt, who hired them, and then thou wouldst have trouble. They will not point to me, for I shall not give my name. Thou art doing ill, not to trust in me, for, setting aside my keenness, remember that there is a question of two other things, of my life, and the reward which thou hast promised me. How much dost thou need? 1,000 sestertia, for turn attention to this, that I must find honest ruffians, men who when they have received earnest money, will not take it off without a trace. For good work there must be good pay. Something might be added too, for my sake, to wipe away the tears which I shall shed out of pity for Glaucus. I take the gods to witness how I love him. If I receive 1,000 sestertia today, 2 days hence his soul will be in Hades. And then, if souls preserve memory and the gift of thought, he will know for the first time how I loved him. I will find people this very day, and tell them that for each day of the life of Glaucus I will withhold 100 sestertia. I have, besides, a certain idea, which seems to me infallible. Vinicius promised him once more the desired sum, forbidding him to mention Glaucus again, but asked what other news he brought, where he had been all the time, what he had seen, and what he had discovered. But Shiloh was not able to tell much. He had been in 2 more houses of prayer, had observed each person carefully, especially the women, but had seen no one who resembled Lydia. The Christians, however, looked on him as one of their own sect, and, since he redeemed the son of Eurysius, they honored him as a man following in the steps of Rist. He had learned from them, also, that a great lawgiver of theirs, a certain Paul of Tarsus, was in Rome, imprisoned because of charges preferred by the Jews, and with this man he had resolved to become acquainted. But most of all was he pleased by this, that the supreme priest of the whole sect, who had been Christ's disciple, and to whom Christ had confided government over the whole world of Christians, might arrive in Rome any moment. All the Christians desired evidently to see him, and hear his teachings. Some great meetings would follow, at which he, Chio, would be present, and what is more, since it is easy to hide in the crowd, he would take Vinicius to those meetings. Then they would find Lydia certainly. If Glaucus were once set aside, it would not be connected even with great danger. As to revenge, the Christians too, would revenge, but in general they were peaceful people. Here Shiloh began to relate, with a certain surprise, that he had never seen, that they gave themselves up to debauchery, that they poisoned wells or fountains, that they were enemies of the human race, worshipped an ass, or ate the flesh of children. No, he had seen nothing of that sort. Certainly he would find among them even people who would hide away Glaucus for money, but their religion, as far as he knew, did not incite to crime, on the contrary, it enjoined forgiveness of offenses. Vinicius remembered what Pomponia had said to him at Acts, and in general he listened to Chio's words with pleasure. Though his feeling for Lydia assumed at times the seeming of hatred, he felt a relief when he heard that the religion which she and Pomponia confessed was neither criminal nor repulsive. But a species of undefined feeling rose in him, that it was just that reverence for Christ, unknown and mysterious, which created the difference between himself and Lydia. Hence he began at once to fear that religion, and to hate it. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.